Investing Simplified is brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm with Bo Caldwell, CFP, and Chuck Price, founder and author of Investing Simplified, the book, and the number one bestseller, Your Retirement Made Simple. Chuck Price has been doing estate planning since 1970 and investing in retirement planning since 1975. Individual situations will vary, and the information on this show should only be relied upon when coordinated with individual professional advice. Other parties present on this broadcast are not affiliated with Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated. Investing Simplified is the longest running live financial show in America with a financial advisor and now a CFP, an estate planning attorney, and a CPA to answer your questions for free, and comes to you live from Portland, Oregon on affiliated stations throughout the Pacific Northwest. You can contact Bo or Chuck by visiting PFGWM. Or you can email them with a question at ask@pfgwm.com. Or you can call them right now at 503-417-9595. That's 503-417-9595. And for our long distance and podcast listeners, you can call toll free at 877-733-1011. That's 877-733-1011. Now, the hosts of Investing Simplified, Chuck Price and Bo Caldwell.
Good morning and welcome to Investing Simplified. Thanks for tuning in this Saturday. This is the time to pick up the phone, give us a call, ask that question that's been keeping you up at night, whether it's about your taxes, your investments, or your estate planning. I'm Bo Caldwell, CFP, in with you this morning. Kevin Stege's still stuck doing taxes, so he's skipping this week. But you know him. You missed him. He was gone for a couple of weeks, but he's back with us. We have Chuck Price in this morning.
Thank you, Bo.
Good morning, Chuck.
Good morning.
And then back with us by popular demand is Taylor Cattell of the KG Law Group. Hi, Taylor. Good morning.
Good morning, Bo.
Thanks for coming in this morning.
Happy to be here.
Well, we're glad to have everybody in this morning. I know for those of you that listened the last couple of weeks, it's just been me, and you've had to listen to me drone on. And I know we've been hoping for Chuck's traditional opening where we talk about the market and where the market's been going. Chuck, I noticed the NASDAQ's been going like crazy the last couple of weeks.
Well, you know, I got to tell you, Bo, actually, since the start of the year, the markets have done very, very well. And of course, I do track the S&P and the Dow for year to date. And right now, as of Friday, March 15th, the S&P, believe it or not, is up 12.59%. And the Dow Jones is up 10.81%. So we have a very good rally market back from a horrible October and a horrible December. And so all you investors out there, I've had people call me on the phone and tell me, you know, how bad their December was. And in our managed portfolios, most of them were able to dodge the bullet. Some of the more aggressive ones are not. But the conservative portfolios certainly dodged a bullet and ended up down about 3.5% for the year, versus 6.5% for the S&P and the Dow. So again, as a long-term investor, if you're retirement and you're investing, you're not investing for a month, you're not investing for a year, you're investing for the next 25 or 30 years, because right now people are living a lot longer. Husband and wife who hit age 70 have a 22-year expectancy for one of them to live. Folks, that's a long time to be without a paycheck. And so you have to look at a long-term perspective on your retirement planning, and don't get upset about a bad month or a bad quarter or a bad year, because you got 20 more coming, and it's going to average out. But you got to have a strategy, and that's really what we're all about, is strategy. I want to give a quick thing here, though, that I think talking about the financial aspect of America, this country right now is $22.128 trillion in debt. Both political parties suck at reducing the debt. And at some point in time, this debt is going to hit the wall. And when it does, we're going to have a major, major catastrophe. So I would encourage you, whatever political persuasion you are, to pick up the phone and call your congressperson and tell them to pledge their pension plan against the national debt. And tell them that you don't want them getting a dime of their retirement until they straighten out the debt of this country that they created. Folks, we don't create the debt. Government politicians create the debt. They need to solve that problem. And it's got to be solved. And I, you know, for Bo and Taylor, the young people, I got to tell you, we're us seniors. I'm a senior citizen. We're leaving this country in a mess. Last time they reported, the amount of money taken out of Social Security was $4.1 trillion of IOUs that they've never paid back. They quit reporting that number. I've looked and looked on the internet. I mean, the only thing, the last one I could find was $4.1 trillion. They quit reporting it because the government spends that money. So you, if you have kids, if you have grandkids, if you have great-grandkids, and you want to see them have an opportunity to live the lives we lived, then you need to tell your congressman they need to get control of the debt. Debt is a big problem. I want to just give a quick note here about the markets. If you go back to the turn of the century, it's kind of amazing to kind of look at what the numbers really are. Because if you look at the 80 years previous to the turn of the century, the S&P did over 10. The Dow Jones did about 9.5. And the NASDAQ was in double digits. But if you go back to 12/31/99 and take a look at what the market's done, the S&P since 12/31/99, so it'd be all 18 years and 18 years and a couple months, the S&P over that period of time, I got to tell you, has done a 5.06% return. That's it. The NASDAQ, 4.88%. That's over the last 18 years. The Dow Jones, 7.21. The Dow Jones is doing 50% better than the S&P. And I've heard a lot of commentators when I was on my vacation. I'd watch the, get up in the morning, watch the business news, and I hear them talking about how finally the S&P is outperforming the Dow. But listen, for the last 18 years, the Dow Jones has handed the S&P their lunch. So if you're a conservative investor, Dow Jones is big, old, and slow, but has outperformed almost by 50% the S&P over the last 18 years. And if you look at your portfolios that you've done, and you hear all these things on financial planning reports, I hear other people on the radio, certainly not Bo or me, where they're talking about a 2% to 3% return. If they're talking about a 2% to 3% long-term, folks, if your investments aren't getting 2% to 3%, you better come talk to us.
Well, that's what's inflation right now. You know, I mean, even in the low, when it was low, it was, you know, 1.5 to 2. And when we use, when I do projections on financial plans and looking, I like to be conservative. We want to, you know, under promise and over deliver. And we've mentioned this before. I've never had a client that got mad that had too much money. You know, but we want to make sure that that folks never run out of money. So we plan for 2.5% or even a 2%, but that's inflation. So if you're only making 2, maybe 3%, then you're really not making any money. And
you're not making money at all. That's correct. Yeah.
So, you know, and for folks that don't know that, you know, we're using inflation interchangeably, but what I like to talk about is, you know, my grandfather paid more for his last car than he did for his first house. And that's what inflation is, right? So over time, if you're talking about people in their 40s or 50s that are, you know, moving towards retirement, they're saving for retirement, and then you retire, stuff just costs more over
time.
Well,
I'm not your grandfather's age, but I'm your dad's age.
Right?
Your dad and I are pretty close in age. But I paid for the last two cars I bought, I paid almost twice as much as I paid for the house that I lived in the longest and lived in for 25 years. So believe me, I understand inflation is there.
Well, and you're not, just so people know, in case you're assuming that, you know, that Chuck's, you know, living high on the hog, he's not buying, you know, BMW, you know, 5 Series. No, he's talking about, you know, nice, responsible cars. They just cost a lot more.
Yeah, I've got a Ford Explorer, and my wife drives a Ford Escape. And prior to that time, I had a Honda Accord that I drove for almost 18 years. And I tend to buy a new car, but then I drive it for 15 to 18 years. Because then if I mess it up, I messed it up, not somebody else. But I just think that if you get a new car, you drive that thing for 18 to 20 years to get your money out of it. And but I can tell you those cars cost more than the major house that I bought that I lived in and raised my kids in. And that's just inflation. And you know what? It's always been here, and it's going to always be here. No matter what we do, it's going to be here. Well, you know what? I am really excited to get to talk to Taylor because I haven't talked to her for a while. I get to talk to you all the time.
Unfortunately, but, for you.
Unfortunately. but I'm really excited to talk to Taylor about things that we were discussing earlier. And so I think in this next segment, we're going to have a great segment. I'm just going to say to all you listeners out there, if you've had problems with banks, if you have problems with estate planning, if you've had some problems in getting your things in your financial house in order, this next segment's going to be for you because we're going to really get into it. So Taylor, we're really looking forward to this.
Thanks, Chuck. I'm excited to share some tips and traps that come with everyday consumers, everybody who works with banks, everybody who works with credit unions. It affects all of us. So
yeah, I love that, trips and traps, tricks and traps, because there's a lot of traps.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the bad thing. And not everybody is there to really help you.
No.
They're maybe just to get you out of the way. So it'll be a great. I don't have a clock, so I can't.
Oh, you're fine. Don't worry. So that's a good way to lead us into it. So why don't we take a quick break and then we can come back and just start fresh with talking with Taylor about trips. Or, God, that's difficult to say. Tricks and traps to get you through the banking
situation. Say that 10 times fast.
Tips, wow. Tricks, and traps.
Yeah.
But as always, pick up the phone, give us a call if you've got a question for us. Otherwise, we'll see you on the other side.
Simplify. Are you concerned about your retirement income? Do you really understand how your Social Security benefits work? Price Financial Group Wealth Management has helped many seniors in Oregon and Washington maximize their Social Security benefits at retirement through using their Social Security seminar on demand. Now you can watch this valuable information in the comfort of your home by just going to www.pfgwm.com and click on the free Social Security kit. If you are serious about your retirement planning, you cannot afford to miss this opportunity. After all, you have invested your hard-earned dollars into Social Security all your working years. So shouldn't you get the maximum return you can get from those dollars? The future can be scary, and without a plan, it can be even scarier, especially when facing the unknown. What you don't know can hurt you. Get your free Social Security kit at pfgwm.com or call 503-253-3000.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, here's Chuck Price and Bo Caldwell.
Thanks for listening to Investing Simplified. We are back in studio with Chuck Price, Bo Caldwell, and Taylor Cattell of the KG Law Group. Taylor, we were warning people ahead of time that we were going to try, I practiced it in the break, tricks and traps of the banking industry. So what do you got for us?
Well, I've been seeing this a lot in my practice. So my practice is both estate planning and estate administration. So what does that mean? That means if somebody's lost capacity or somebody's died, how do their family members step up and help? And banks are notoriously difficult to work with. They're sure friendly when you open an account. And then from there on, it tends to be maybe maintained, maybe goes down. There's a wide discrepancy between different banks and credit unions. So I don't mean to bash any one bank. Some are worse than others, but all of them have behind the scenes going on that you don't necessarily know about. What is it that the tellers are being rewarded for that is not apparent to the consumer? And also, how do you make sure that your own stuff is in order the way you want it to be? Whether that's a joint account owner or a pay on death beneficiary designation, it's not always apparent, and there's a lot of things that go wrong if you're not an educated consumer. So the thing that happens often, and we were just talking about some horror stories, is when you set up an account and you initially set up either a joint owner or beneficiary designation, which can be the same as called a POD, a pay on death, a TOD, a transfer on death. That all means the same thing. If you die, this is where this money goes, regardless of what your estate plan says. If you have a will that says, I want everything to be split equally between my kids, but you put one kid on as a joint owner, even if it's for convenience, that means that that's that child's money too. And not just upon your death, right now. So if your child gets divorced, if your child files for bankruptcy, if your child gets in a car accident and it's their fault and somebody's suing them, all your money could be taken away because it's technically equally your child's money. So a lot of people don't understand that a joint ownership, that's a big deal. Using a power of attorney to help if something were to happen to you, that's the right legal way to make sure your money is your money, but somebody can step in and help you. But what happens often is you set it up maybe without a joint owner, but you say, yeah, on my death, I want it to go to this person. And then say that person is your wife, and then you get divorced, and then you get remarried. And guess what? That might still be that first wife as the beneficiary, and that is a contract. That you can have a whole new estate plan, you can be very thoughtful, you can have a revocable living trust, you could do everything right. You go into your financial advisors and you say, yep, I'm all good, I've got a trust, everything's in the trust. And they look at you and they say, did you call? And you say, sure, of course I did. And maybe you didn't get in writing, maybe you didn't get confirmation, whatever it is. Or maybe you don't know who to call, or they're not particularly helpful in navigating. But that initial beneficiary designation stays until you change it.
You know, Taylor, one of the things, too, that I've noticed throughout the years, with all the bank mergers and all the transitions that have taken place, we've had our clients, sometimes we go back and recheck beneficiaries. They may have had beneficiaries set up at Bank A, but when Bank A got bought by Bank B and they transitioned all the reports over and all the records over, not always do they pick up the card file. They pick up what's in the computer. And if somebody didn't go in the computer and add that beneficiary, it might be on your card statement that you signed up at the bank, but it doesn't transcend over to your new account.
Yep.
And so we've had people, we tell them constantly, you got to go back and check with your bank and verify you have a beneficiary on there, that you have beneficiaries on your bank account, because people who think they have a will or a living trust that everything is hunky-dory and it's going to go exactly the way you want it is not right, because their life insurance, their bank accounts, their retirement accounts are passed by beneficiary, not by will or not by your trust.
Exactly.
And that's where people get always screwed up with thinking, oh, I have this all in order, so therefore it's all done.
Right. And the most important takeaway is that your estate plan does not trump your beneficiary designations. The beneficiary designations are a contract, and those will decide by operation of law where your stuff goes, regardless of what you want, regardless of your marital status, regardless of what your will says. You have to go in and actually change that contract while you have capacity to do so.
Yeah, we constantly recommend our clients that once a year they contact their company and verify their beneficiaries on their 401ks or on their retirement accounts, because sometimes even in companies when changeovers take effect, I was telling you about this earlier, we had a client come in and we were checking all their stuff and found out on an old 401k that was with a company they hadn't been with for 20 years, that 25 years ago they got divorced and then got remarried, and the old 401k still had the original spouse on there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was $100,000. If she had died, that would have went to her first husband, not her second husband.
Mm-hmm.
Would not have been a happy household.
And there's very little you can do about it, because legally, that's what's supposed to happen. So there's not a lot of rights to claim against that first spouse. That money was designated to that first spouse.
Yeah, and her memory was, she swore, she said, I know it's set up correctly.
Mm-hmm.
So we did call and verify it, and we verified that it wasn't set up correctly. So people need to check that.
Mm-hmm. I had a really interesting... Okay.
So sorry to interrupt you guys right there, but we have a couple of callers on the line, wanted to make sure that we get to them. I think the most important thing to make sure we finish on that, and we'll come back to it after the calls, is call into your institutions, make sure that you know that the beneficiary designations is set up the way that you want, because the big thing I heard you say is that is what trumps your estate plan, is what that contract is.
Exactly,
so,
right.
So we're going to take a call here. We have David on the line. David, you have a credit card balance forgiveness question?
Yes. I had someone tell me the other day that, first of all, the scenario is, this is a single person, has no wife or husband, never has, and they are charging things to credit cards, and I put an S on that, even though I've suggested that might be the wrong thing, but they keep these credit cards with balances on them, and I don't want to get into that it takes X number of many years to pay off if you just make the minimum payment. But what I want to know is, they said that they were told by someone that should know what they're talking about that when they pass away, even though they have a bit, even though they have an heir to their estate, as minuscule as it might be, that credit card balances are forgiven. Is there any truth to that, or is that up to each credit card company?
Here's how I would phrase it. That is not correct. Credit card balances are a debt. That is a debt. There's nothing special about credit cards except for the fact that they are used to getting pennies on the dollar as opposed to some other debts. They know that they are unsecured in most circumstances, so it is often one of the debts that you can negotiate more than others. Credit card companies take different stances on that. So the simple black and white answer is no, they are a debt. But the more complicated answer is it really depends on what they can go after somebody dies. So there are certain ways to protect assets from creditors, and that gets more complex into what assets do you actually have, how are they held, who are your heirs, and what would be, first of all, searchable, what would be findable, how much money do you have, is it a solvent estate, is it an insolvent estate, meaning you don't have enough money to pay your debts. But usually credit card companies are last in line to get paid in a probate context or in a trust administration. But they do get paid in some way or another. I have a lot of clients right now who are dealing with similar situations, multiple credit cards, because I don't have a lot of sympathy for the credit card companies. They are lending basically to people who they know can't pay, banking on those high interest rates, banking on those penalties. It's really
predatory.
It's really predatory. So it is absolutely something to be aware of. If there's not going to be an estate at the end, I don't necessarily feel badly for my clients who are running up the credit card debt because there's not going to be any money to pay it off anyway. And your kids are not going to be, I don't want to be too black and white about it, but generally speaking, if you don't have enough money to pay your debts, that debt gets settled out at your estate and it doesn't pass on automatically to your kids. So there is some protection for your kids, but that's in an insolvent estate, and nobody wants to be in an insolvent estate. You want to have some money to leave to your legacy.
This person is single and has never been married and has a family member, not me, as their beneficiary or person who gets whatever might be left over, which would be the television and the car and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And the credit card debt. They do not have a house or anything like that debt. And they just said, I'm going to run up my credit cards because they don't get paid. And I thought, I just couldn't believe that one.
They may or may not be true in the actual practical facts of that case. The credit card debt may ultimately not get paid. But from a legal standpoint, they're still a creditor of the estate. And if there is something in there,
so what I'm hearing you say is possibly, and obviously we're saying all this with a caveat of,
yes,
David, of not knowing specifically what the circumstances are. And, you know, obviously Taylor's not the
right
representative on the
exactly
case. So, but just in generally speaking, what it sounds like to me is you're saying this person has, in terms of assets, they have TV and a car and some other personal property, but no real money. So the credit card debt in that situation, generally speaking, would not pass on to their heir. What the estate would do is settle out, and they would go out. They would try to go after the car and the television, you know, any
right
sort of personal property to help settle that debt. But if that debt exceeded what personal property they could liquidate and get cash for, then that's not something that passes to their heirs necessarily. Now, situationally, it could, but generally speaking, it wouldn't.
Exactly.
Bad debt column.
Right.
Right. Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Well, thank you for calling, David. Really appreciate it. That's a good question. We also have Lee on the line. Lee has a question specifically for you, Taylor, about an estate.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I am my dad is still alive. He has set up a living trust. I'm the executor on the estate, and my brother has a durable power of attorney. And everything is, and so he's taking care of all the bills that are going on right now. Dad's in a retirement home. And Marty, my brother, is a co-signer on everything's under the living trust except for a checking account with an attached Visa card to it. And this is back in Indiana. And I understand that once Dad would die, then that durable power of attorney ends. And I also understand, I hope correctly, that then the monies in that account would go to my brother, or would now be his. And now he's honest, so I'm not worrying about him running off with that money. We'd still be working together to pay off stuff. But is there a... Is that true, number one? And number two, Taylor, how would you set up things so, say, if he was an untrustworthy brother, how would you set up an ongoing checking account? You don't want to set it up under a living trust, I wouldn't think. But how would you do it to make it a cleaner thing? And then, plus, how does that pass under my purview then after the after Dad dies and the durable power of attorney goes kaput?
Excellent questions. I'll start with two caveats. One is I can't give you legal advice because I don't have all the actual information. So I'll just talk in general terms that will hopefully help give you some sense. The other is that I'm not licensed in Indiana. And every state has very specific laws on how things work and how living trusts might be dealt with. So I'll speak more to what happens with Oregon and Washington, since that's where I am licensed, in very general terms. A power of attorney is only effective while somebody, the principal, is alive. That does end on someone's death. When you say co-signer on account, it makes me pause. That goes back to the banking question of what exactly is a co-signer. Could that be a joint owner, or is that using the power of attorney, or is that an authorized user? There's a lot of different terms that banks use, and it's not clear what that authority is. So I would say for anybody who thinks that they're a co-signer, push the bank on that, and remember that the banks will try to give you legal advice without telling you that it's legal advice, and they shouldn't give you legal advice. The best thing is to bring a statement to an attorney, maybe call your bank with your attorney present, and talk to a manager and figure out exactly what is the authority on every account. The other piece of it is that one of the most important benefits of a revocable living trust, at least the way they're used in Oregon and Washington, is that it's there during someone's lifetime as well as upon their death. And so what I do see with a lot of my clients is a misunderstanding of the roles. What is a personal representative or an executor? When do they come into power? What is the agent under a power of attorney? When does that start or stop? When does a trustee have some power, and over what assets? And some people have a different person named in a power of attorney than they do in their revocable living trust. Basically, in general terms, the trustee controls all assets owned by the trust, whether it's incapacity or death. And a power of attorney could control all assets that are not in the trust, usually things like life insurance, retirement accounts, and then other, you know, payment of bills and things like that. So having the same person named in all your documents can be critical, because they might have to wear a different legal hat depending on what asset they're dealing with. And having different people named could become a conflict. So the trustee is a general term that's both upon somebody's, you know, during somebody's life, incapacity or death. An executor or personal representative doesn't have authority until someone's died, and that's usually under a will. And an agent has authority depending on what the power of attorney says. That could not be until somebody has, you know, lost their capacity, or it could be immediately effective, but that ends upon someone's death. So the different roles are different. It is confusing. And the documents themselves will give a lot of direction on when are they effective, what does that mean, and understand the assets. So I would really strongly say that you should talk to an attorney about it. If your dad is in Indiana, then talk to somebody in Indiana to get a better sense of what your duties are. And for anybody out there who has a similar situation where there are multiple siblings usually working with different assets, it's really important that you coordinate, communicate, make everything transparent, because that's the stuff that even if you don't, you might love each other, you might not like each other. That's common. That's okay. But transparency during someone's life is what's going to save a lot of money and make the pot bigger when someone passes away or loses capacity, because that information, getting that direction from the person who matters, the usually the parent, saying, this is what I want. If you have any questions, this is what's happened before, they can't give you direction. It's really important to clear things up. And this is the stuff that gets really expensive when someone dies. Someone dies and the siblings are going after each other saying, well, you borrowed $100,000 from dad. No, I didn't. He gave it to me. All that stuff, that costs a lot of money and attorney's fees to sort out, making the pot smaller that you get to split.
Got it. All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good question.
Thank you, Lee. Thanks for calling in. We're going to take another quick break here, but we're going to be back. I'd like to get back to talking about some more tricks and traps with the banking world. We got started with that and had some great questions call in. But again, if you have questions, please call in and ask them. We'd love to answer them for you. Thanks for listening to Investing Simplified.
Price Financial Group, Wealth Management.
Hello, this is Kevin Stege, shareholder with Baker & Coulson Certified Public Accountants, serving the Portland and Southwest Washington areas for almost 40 years. We are a full-service accounting and consulting firm offering our services to a wide range of business and individual clients. One of the largest expenses to a household or a business is its tax burden. While off-the-shelf tax products can help file simple returns, they can't know your plans for the future and not only provide insight and planning to help you get there, but actually help you along the way. There are just some things that can't be replaced by experience. Whether you are just beginning your working career or have a well-established business with many employees, rely on the professionals at Baker & Coulson to help in an efficient, accurate, and personalized manner. We are located at 2414 Northeast Division in Gresham and can be reached at our website at bakercoulson.com or 503-666-5569. That's bakercoulson.com, 503-666-5569. And remember, at Baker & Coulson, our service is the product our clients remember most.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, here's Chuck Price and Bo Caldwell.
Thanks for listening to Investing Simplified. I am Bo Caldwell here with Chuck Price and Taylor Cattell. If you have a question for us, like to give us a call at 503-417-9595 or 877-733-1011. So, guys, I wanted to get back to talking a little bit about those tricks and traps with the banking world. We were talking a little bit, you know, before the show started specifically, and Lee kind of brought it up to me and made me think about it, but it's when you have those bank accounts that may or may not be in the trust name. I don't know if there's a rule of thumb, Taylor, in terms of if someone has a living trust and with the bank accounts, but specifically when someone passes away and if there isn't a POD, a TOD, or any of those beneficiary designations, or the account's not in the name of the trust, kind of what are your remedies for that if that happens?
Yeah, very good question. That comes up a lot. And it depends in, there's a couple different pieces. One is, like we talked about a little bit before, is there a joint owner on the account as well? Because that joint owner would get it by operation law. Assuming it's just owned by one person, nothing else would pass by operation of law. There are a couple options depending on the state in which you live. Most states have some version of a small estate affidavit or a small estate process that allows you to not go through the full probate process. So when I say probate, what I mean is the court supervises how assets get from A to B, and it can be expensive. There's filing fees. You have to publish notice in some states. In Oregon, you do. In Washington, it's optional. There's some mandatory waiting periods, and 6 months is really a very fast time period. So that's not what most people want to wait in order to get, especially a small amount in a bank account. So definitely talk to an attorney before going forward. You can do some self-help options, but even half an hour with an attorney can be enough to get you started on what is available in my state and how do I help myself. But in Oregon, you can use what's called a Small Estate Act affidavit, and there are limits on that. So in Oregon, you can't have more than $75,000 in personal property $200,000 in real property. So there's not a lot of houses or even pieces of land in Portland now that are going to meet that threshold. But in other parts of Oregon and Washington, there still are. Washington has, you can't have any real property, but they also have very different rules as far as how probate process goes. So Washington can be a lot less expensive in probate than some of the requirements of Oregon. It gets more complex, but the long and short of it is that there are some small options. So a lot of people choose to keep a small checking account out of their revocable living trust if they do have a trust. Generally speaking, my rule of thumb is keep it under $20,000. If you have anything that's outside of your trust or anything that isn't somehow coordinated with your estate plan, keep it a smaller value and make sure that you have cash available in some other way, because there are always costs. You got to pay for death certificates. You got to pay for funeral. You're not going to have the legal authority, or in most cases, you don't have the legal authority you need for immediate costs. So whether it's a savings account in the trust or life insurance that pays out pretty quickly, or making sure that your kids or your personal representative is financially stable. It's a good idea anyway, so that there's no temptation there, but that they have some money that they would be able to loan right up front for funeral expenses and things like that. Having some cash immediately available is a really, really good idea, so that then you can figure out what your options are for that bank account. Is that helpful?
Yeah, absolutely. That makes sense. So I think the one thing worth clarifying as well, just because it was something that I struggled to understand it, you know, at first, is so the different. Talk a little bit about the difference between personal property and real property, because you kind of
So real property is land or a house, anything that basically has a chain of title with the county. Personal property is everything else: bank accounts, to intangibles. So most estates are not going to put a high value on the stuff in your home, clothing, stuff on the walls, household goods. That's usually valued at, let's say, garage sale value. But for the most part, people, creditors, don't want that stuff. So when I'm thinking of the valuations of what is it that's outside of your estate plan, we're usually looking at cash bank accounts or retirement accounts, keeping those to a minimum, with, unless you have a beneficiary designation or something in place.
Sure. And that, you know, unless they have a first edition Jackson Pollock or something like that.
Right. Okay. And there are some very high value pieces. So it's important to think about how that coordinates with your overall paintings, art. Sure. And there are things that you can do ahead of time that make it much, much easier.
Perfect. That makes sense to me. And the other question I was, you know, wanting to ask, I was excited to have you on because we've had Chuck and I get this question a lot in practice, just with folks, but in when I'm talking to people too, is there a rule of thumb that you use? You know, we've talked to other attorneys about it in the past, but is in terms of when a living trust makes sense as opposed to just a simple will for folks? Because a lot of times, you know, when we meet with clients, that's one of our first questions in the financial checkup is, do you have a will? Or a trust? Do you have, financial power of attorney set up? Do you have the medical directives, all that sort of stuff set up, the basic docs? But and when was it last reviewed? But in terms of the question comes up where, well, I don't have enough to need a trust. And when does it kind of make sense to have, you know, do you have a rule of thumb on that or thoughts on why it makes sense to spend a little bit more on a trust now rather than probate later?
Absolutely. I have lots of thoughts, but I'll try to keep it simple. My baseline is it is always better to have something than nothing. Anything is better than nothing. So if all you can afford or all you're comfortable with is a will, power of attorney, and advance directive, get the will, power of attorney, and advance directive. That may be less expensive. It may be simpler. The other rule of thumb is understand what you have. If you don't understand what you have, it's not going to do you nearly as good. So that's another really important piece of the puzzle. If you are in a place where a trust just doesn't really make a lot of sense to you when you're talking with an attorney about it, then go with something you're comfortable with, because it's more important you understand. The most common misconception is that I don't have enough money to warrant a trust. I do not go based on the value of your assets. Tax planning wise, you can do tax planning, whether it's through a will or through a trust, coordinating how you want to minimize and offer creditor protection, things like that. That's all the same through a will or trust. How do you protect money for kids or grandkids? That's the same with a will or a trust. So a lot of the tools can be the same. I look at the nature of the assets and the client's values. Is privacy a really high value of a client? If it is, a trust is a much better way to go, regardless of how simple or small the assets are. Are there really large blended families? That can get really complicated with the notice requirements in probate. So they can be a much more streamlined, simplified, and cost-effective to have a trust. Cost-wise, I don't think I've seen a situation where it didn't pan out to be more cost-effective to have a trust. You pay, it's just when do you pay? And if you pay up front, it makes it, generally speaking, much easier on everybody else and much less expensive in the back. So probate, I said earlier, is the court-supervised process of getting assets from A to B. That costs money. You have a filing fee that, aside from attorney's fees, you have a filing fee with the court. You have the cost of publishing notice. You're looking at out of the gate anywhere from $500 to $1,500 in hard costs, not attorney's fees, just hard costs. If a trust costs about $1,000 up front, you've saved that money just in hard costs. So it really is just, do you want to do the paperwork? Are your assets, are you going to be benefited from a trust value-wise and asset-wise? So it's very individual. But again, my rule of thumb, something is better than nothing. Understand what you have and talk to an attorney about whether you feel comfortable and you would be benefited by how a trust works.
It makes sense to me. I mean, I feel like we're both just listening going, this is wacky. This is perfect for when we're talking to clients.
Yeah,
about.
I mean, I got to tell you, I personally prefer the living trust. I've had one myself for a long time, but from being in this business for as many years as I have, and having as many clients pass away, and then having to pass the money to their heirs, for us, a living trust is a very simple thing, because we can simply move the assets in about 10 minutes
mm-hmm.
and,
exactly.
and redistribute them to the heirs. It's a very easy process. The thing that I think is one of the things, there's a attorney, and this is nothing bad about attorneys, but attorneys have two school of thoughts. One is everything's going to go through probate no matter what, no matter how big the estate is, they're going to do probate because that's what their thing is. And the other one is the attorneys who do the trust say, no, you know, we want to avoid going through probate if we can and save the client some money and get the money directly to the heirs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the two schools that I've seen from the attorneys I've dealt with. But and I've had some discussions with attorneys on that, because one of my particular clients has about $1 million of retirement assets, but they also have over $700,000 of property.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they only have one child, so everything's going to pass directly to that one child. That's from an easy standpoint. They have no grandchildren yet. But and I still look at that. The trust is such a better deal for them,
mm-hmm.
and their attorney is not having them do a trust. And so I kind of get into headbutt there with them because the client come back to me and said, I don't understand this. Why wouldn't I do a trust?
Mm-hmm.
And I have a problem understanding that myself.
I had a client lay that at me this week. He said, well, why wouldn't I do a trust? Because I don't like my clients to feel upsold. I don't want them to think, you know, if you Google, do I need a trust? Every single article is going to say yes. And I think that is not always right. But for the most part, it is. I mean, for the most part, having a trust is simpler. It's more cost effective. It's easier on everyone. It's more private. Even if you don't have a lot of money, it's just so much easier on everybody else around you. And so when that client asked me, well, why wouldn't I have a trust? I had to pause and think, well, when are there times that I recommend a will? It is almost entirely because my clients aren't comfortable with the concept of a trust, at least at that point in their lives. If I have a young couple, just had their first kid, and they're saying, we just want a really basic something, we don't have a lot, we just want to get something in place for our kids, I would rather that they're comfortable both with the cost and with the process. It's not that they wouldn't be better served with a trust. I still think they would, but meeting the clients where they're at is more where I'm coming from. But generally speaking, most clients are better served with a trust. But understanding what you have, understanding your estate plan is ultimately my highest priority, that the clients don't feel like they're upsold or that they have something that's just this newfangled thing that they don't understand and they didn't want and all of that.
It makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, that's the biggest thing for us, is understanding when to send, you know, folks that way and ask them, tell them they you know, probably should do a trust. And it's good for folks to hear what the benefits are, rather than us just seeming like we're upselling them to,
yes, exactly.
To
partners.
And the thing is, we don't trade it. You know, just so our listeners know, we have no financial arrangement with Taylor or any other attorney that we have on our show. We just don't operate that. We're a fiduciary. So we work in the best interest of our client, and we refer our clients to attorneys like Taylor to, you know, take care of those questions and stuff. So we have no financial gain to upsell them or
right,
to sell
right.
them. But our concern is to get it set up the least restrictive way for them and for their heirs.
Because you have to answer to their heirs.
That's right. That's exactly right. Well, listen, you got to take a break,
yeah,
right?
We're going to take our last break here, and we'll be right back. We're going to talk a little bit more about, kind of expound on these issues, because I think it's a really good place that we're in. But if you have a question for us, give us a call, 503-417-9595 or 877-733-1011. Thanks for listening to Investing Simplified.
Investing Simplified. Hello, my name is Carl Jepsen, estate planning attorney and co-host of the long-running radio talk show Investing Simplified. My law practice emphasizes estate planning and probate. My mission statement is practical estate planning for peace of mind. This means that I listen carefully to my clients. I explain the various estate planning techniques and documents in the most understandable terms that I can. I try to make sure that my clients are comfortable with what we are doing together before proceeding, and I discuss my fees up front so that clients don't get any unwanted surprise. Estate planning and probate don't have to be that complicated. My experienced staff and I work closely with our clients to guide them through both of these matters in the simplest and most efficient manner possible. My office is located in the White Office Building at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 101, right across the street from Mall 205. My telephone number is 971-229-0585, and my website is carljepsenlaw.com.
You're listening to Investing Simplified. Now, here's Chuck Price and Bo Caldwell.
All right, welcome back to Investing Simplified, and I think, like I mentioned before, we were in a good groove talking about some issues that we've definitely come across, you know, in our practices, folks that were asking those questions all the time. So it's hard to interrupt your guys' groove before. I don't want to, you know, kind of get back to it, but sort of that trust question. So, you know, Chuck and I talk about Taylor a lot of times just from a monetary perspective. If someone, like that situation we talked about, the client's got $700,000 in real property value, a lot of times kind of the rule of thumb that we've been using is, if you have doesn't matter what else it is, but $300,000 to $400,000 in real property, that's going to cost you a grip to go through probate anyway. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean I know that depends on the attorney and depends on the filing process, but if it's going to be a couple $3,000 to get a trust set up now, mm-hmm. or your heirs have to pay $15,000, $20,000, $25,000 to go through probate to get all that taken care of, kind of what's more important to you, right? I mean, that's
right. Right. There's the cost, but then there's also what I'll bring up with real property. There's two things that I want to make sure people are educated about. One is that you don't want to have to liquidate your real property, right? And things right. cost money. And so if the majority of your estate is in real property, keeping in mind that Oregon only has a estate tax exemption of $1 million, which in Portland you'd be shocked, what that house you bought for less than your first car or your most recent car, that's probably worth a lot more than you think it is. And there's some step up in basis and other tax benefits to keeping that in your name, passing away with it. But that means you got a bigger estate. And if you don't have money to pay the estate tax and pay the costs, then you might have to liquidate a property and quick. Don't put yourself in that situation. So think ahead and talk to an attorney about how to avoid it. So real property is another piece where if you own even one piece of property, whatever value you think it is probably more. And sit down and figure out what's the best way. The other thing I want to mention about real property is something called a transfer on death deed. Have you guys heard of this? Are your clients asking questions about this? So they are a well-intentioned idea that, in my opinion, has gone terribly wrong. There are a couple major issues with transfer on death deeds, and they should only be used, in my opinion, in very, 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 very limited circumstances. One is that it doesn't stop creditors from coming forward, but it takes away your normal tools to deal with paying off those creditors. So you are not protecting that asset from debts. It just makes it more complicated and often more expensive. I've got a situation now where son was living in a house with dad, providing for dad. There's a transfer on death deed, gave him the money. Creditor started a probate and said, now you have to liquidate the house to pay off our debts. Not only does he have to do that, but he's not in control of the attorney's fees that they're racking up because they're the ones that started the process. So there's going to be a really high attorney fee bill because they've got no interest in making it economical. So there's some issues that come with that. The other thing I've seen is transfer on death deeds that are used in place of a will. And now you've got eight different beneficiaries who are all co-owners of one property. Some of them want to stay there. Some of them might be living there. How do you sort out who gets what when you've got eight owners? And that wasn't necessarily your intention. Even two owners can be highly problematic. So you might hear about transfer on death deeds as a shortcut to probate. Really talk with an attorney. Think through what does that actually mean before you jump on that as an easy shortcut.
You know, one of the concerns I have with the case we were kind of talking about earlier is that somebody has $700,000 in real property, but they got close to $1 million in a retirement account.
Right.
And what in the state of Oregon, if you're over $1 million, and that includes your retirement accounts, mm-hmm. you have what's called an Oregon estate tax.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, somebody in that situation is way better with a trust, so you can do some real planning for them and for their heirs, and particularly for the surviving spouse.
Yes, and you still have the issue, even with a trust, of where do you pay your estate tax? And that's where you got to talk to your financial advisors to say, how am I going to have the cash for myself so I don't have to liquidate my property?
How can we minimize the damage?
Exactly.
Yeah, because there's going to be damage.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, the kitschy question that I will oftentimes answer is, who do you want to disinherit? Would you rather disinherit your kids or the government? And I think we all agree I'd rather disinherit the government.
Yeah, absolutely.
Personally.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, or at least as much as we can. We always, you know, one of the things people have to realize in retirement plans is you always have a partner. You don't own that money 100%.
Mm-hmm.
You have a liability to the government, and they're going to get their pound of flesh.
Mm-hmm.
The best you can do is minimize the amount. That they're going to get something, but you want to minimize as much as you can.
And there's a lot of preventative medicine out there.
That's correct.
Yep. But there's not so many things that you can do on the back end.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. After you've passed, it's kind of
after you've lost capacity.
Oh, yeah, that's
really
a good point.
Right. It's not just death that you're worried about. A lot of people say, "Well, I can." It's easier to process death. Incapacity is where the game changes.
Yeah. Sure. Totally. Without proper durable power of attorneys and directives, you can really mess up a well-planned estate.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I mean, we've seen it numerous times. And the thing is, the hardest thing for all of us to face is our own mortality.
Mm-hmm.
That's the hardest thing for everybody to face. Nobody likes to talk about the fact that, you know, when the hearse is rolling up, they're picking up your body and you're going to be gone. But at some point, we're all going to reach that. Well, hey, how does somebody get a hold of you?
They can give me a call, 503-878-8948, Taylor Cattell with KG Law Group.
And How do they get hold of us, Bo?
Well, they can call us at 503-253-3000. You can also visit Chuck and my website at www.pfgwm.com, or you can send us an email at ask@pfgwm.com, or send it directly to Chuck or I at that same web address.
And thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with Investing Simplified.
Have a great day. Have a great rest of your weekend, and God bless.
Price Financial Group, wealth management. Price Financial Group, wealth management. Price Financial Group, wealth management.
Navigating through today's financial investment world can seem pretty scary. Now, here's the good news. Chuck Price, president of Price Financial Group Wealth Management, introduces a new revolutionary concept that will change how you invest now and in the future. It's called Asset Lock. Asset Lock monitors your investment accounts 24/7, 365, and alerts you when action needs to be taken. And now, Chuck Price offers Asset Lock. At Price Financial Group Wealth Management, we believe all our clients deserve to have Asset Lock monitoring their accounts. So call Chuck today or online at pfgwm.com and learn how you can get Asset Lock on your accounts today for free. Price Financial Group Wealth Management, because the smart investor knows what you don't know can hurt you.
Simplify.
Call 503-253-3000. That's 503-253-3000. You can listen to past shows of Investing Simplified or sign up for our free newsletter at www.pfgwm.com. This show was brought to you by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated, a registered investment advisor firm located at 555 Southeast 99th Avenue, Suite 103, Portland, Oregon, 97216, 503-253-3000, or 877-50-PRICE. Investing Simplified is a registered trademark owned by Price Financial Group Wealth Management Incorporated.